On the one hand, you're lucky. I'm not going to give a sermon today. On the other hand, this is more of a lecture. So I'd rather have a sermon. They're usually shorter. I'll try to keep this the standard amount of time. I want to start with a story. Tuesday, my wife and children and I drove to Anchor Park in Farragut, which has a beautiful park for the kids with a giant sandbox and a bike loop that I like to do. So we drove out there together. I got to spend time with the kids on the way, and then I went on a bike ride for about an hour and met back with them and played in the sandbox. And they all needed to go to the bathroom before we went back in the car. And my children, as you may know, like to wear pajamas every chance they get. So I took Adine, my third child, to the bathroom. And a man whom I assume was maybe a groundskeeper in the area said, "Oh, I'll let you go in with her first." I think he was uncomfortable to be in a bathroom with a small child, which is understandable. Though, to me, excessively polite, it wouldn't have bothered me. And I assumed he called Adine her because we haven't cut Adine's hair yet. And unlike some of our other children's, Adine's hair has gotten quite long. But he said, "Well, she's wearing pink pajamas. He's wearing pink pajamas, so I made a mistake." And it didn't bother me terribly. I found the whole thing amusing. But the assumption that pink is somehow a gendered color, I struggle with more and more. In fact, Elchanan somehow received the message from his peers to come home and tell us that he couldn't have long hair anymore, and he had tried to cut his own hair, and that his brother Avishai couldn't wear purple anymore because those were girl things. To which I thought to myself, "I'm going to find the child who told you that and murder them." So the questions of gender identity and, more prominently in this week's parasha, sexual identity are very germane and difficult to solve in the context of our Torah. And this isn't just a lecture, it's a lecture with an opinion. I'm not going to pretend to be giving you neutral and unmediated information. This is my opinion. So we hear in Leviticus 18:22 and echoed in chapter 20, verse 13, the famous line, "A man should not lie with another man as one would lie with a woman that is a to'evah." Most people, most translations call abomination. I've talked about this before. That to me is not what to'evah means. And I can give you examples both from Genesis and slightly differently from Deuteronomy to illustrate it. Let's think about them together, what the word to'evah might mean. So in Genesis, in the story of Joseph, Joseph uses the word to'evah to describe the situation of Hebrews sharing a table, sharing table fellowship, eating together with Egyptians. He says that's a to'evah, for them, I think, specifically. He says that Egyptians view shepherds as a to'evah. And in Deuteronomy, a similar phrase is used, to'evat Hashem, a to'evah in the eyes of or to God, or a godly to'evah. And we hear different things, that one of them is idols and fetishes. That is a big, major issue in our Torah, that we not observe or sanctify other deities. Other nations' God are called a to'evat Hashem. Eating animals other than ungulates, that is cows, sheep, giraffes, is a to'evah. Using sorcery or other magic is a to'evah. Cross-dressing, wearing the clothes of the opposite gender, is a to'evah. A man remarrying his divorced wife. Unequal weights and measures, and again back to, this is all consecutively in Deuteronomy, molten images, cast images of other deities. So I think they're really describing, Mary Douglas hints at this in her work, that there is a sort of a bell curve of human experience. And our ancestors were more comfortable with things that they viewed within the bell curve. Which is to say, if you're going to be a land animal, the center of the bell curve, the most common thing that they knew was an ungulate. Those are okay to eat. If you're going to be a sea animal, the most common thing, the standard, the most typical item, is a fish with fins and scales. Being a scallop or a shrimp or a catfish is very unusual. They were excluding the fringes of a bell curve, the standard deviations away of human experience, of animal experience. So I think they're not implying, to'evah doesn't necessarily signal an abomination with a divine retribution attached or divine scorn attached, to me, to my interpretation, what that word indicates is a social taboo. It is a taboo, which is a powerful thing at a given time in a society, but clearly is context-specific, is specific to a certain time, place, and understanding of human and animal life. They could have used different words. Again, this is lecturally. I'm not going to be promulgating my opinions as I would in a sermon or trying to teach you a moral, but I do want to illustrate things that our Torah says. There are other words they could have used to describe homosexual, or in the case I also described, transvestitism, dressing in the opposite gender. They could have called it depravity, zima, which is sexually deviant behavior. They did not. They used that word to describe bestiality. This parsha also illustrates points about how to behave pre and post menstruation. There are small children in the room, so this will be a scientific talk, let's say. I'm not going to avoid, it won't be obscene, but it will be direct and clear. They didn't know gender and sexuality as we did. They were concerned about it. They wanted to seclude and preclude and narrow the range of sexual behaviors, but they also weren't really prudes. And Brad Artson makes a point, one of my mentors makes a point, that there is nowhere in the Torah that homosexuality is excluded in the context of homosexual love. They couldn't prevent or prohibit what they didn't know of. There's nowhere in the ancient world where we understand homosexual loving relationships. They didn't particularly exist. Physical relationships, intimate physical relationships, were almost entirely predicated on power differentials, from man to woman, from non-slave to slave, from man to lower status man. They were not predicated on loving, intimate relationships. Though they may have evolved, and those certainly did exist, what they understood of sexuality was, in some ways, oppressive. So we can understand, perhaps, that what they were forbidding was either oppressive sexual behaviors that they viewed outside of the standards of a bell curve, sexual behaviors in general, that they did not understand within the context of their society, time and place dependent context of their society, they viewed them as a taboo. What also they may have been concerned with, and our sages may have gone further on this, is sexual excess, compulsive sexual behaviors. Maimonides was very open. He describes and echoes the Talmud in being very comfortable with the varieties of human sexual experience. At the same time, Shabtai Cohen, writing in the 17th century, and Maimonides writing several centuries earlier, refers to some of these prohibitions as ways to narrow the spectrum of human sexuality to protect us from what can be an overwhelming impulse. Sexuality can take over one's life. It can be addiction. It can be an addiction. It certainly can be compulsive. So maybe what our sages understood these laws to be sort of narrowing sexuality to a healthy amount. And what Shabtai Cohen says in the 1600s is that maybe it was the odd admixtures, again, the bell curve, linen and wool. They didn't like linen and wool. They didn't like matching different animals under the same yoke. They felt that there was necessity for things to pair in a way that they found aesthetically pleasing. Again, aesthetics is not a permanent condition, nor is it inherent to any one thing. And Maimonides tells us that the laws against forbidden sexual intercourse, which we see expanded in part of this parsha, are to inculcate the lesson that we ought to limit sexual intercourse altogether. He says, hold it in contempt and desire it very rarely. He was tough. Maimonides was very severe. Not a fun guy. I always thought Maimonides would not be fun to spend time with. And Gil Steinlauf, I've told his story not long ago. He wrote a letter to his congregation. He's a rabbi now, recently leaving his congregation in D.C. He developed it into an amazing program. He wrote a letter to his congregation a few years ago, telling them the very difficult thing that he and his wife were divorcing, which for a community that prizes family, it's a hard thing to come out about. And then the second sentence was, We're divorcing because I've come to realize that I'm gay. But he wrote this, a sermon, a high holiday sermon called The Queerness of Love, prior to that realization, or maybe as part of the unfolding realization of his own sexuality. He had conducted his first same-sex wedding, and he said that he thinks this is fully within our tradition. We Jews are, I'm quoting at length, we Jews are a people who have never quite fit into the categories of peoplehood or religion that other nations do. Our presence in the world has been often a source of anxiety for others. In this way, we Jews have always been a queer people. I use the term queer deliberately. To be queer is to be troubling, unsettling, not meeting expectations of the way others might want things to be. In fact, it's the Jews' queerness in the world that captures our particular divine message to humanity. Another rabbi he cites, David Bun Bauer, says that the existence of God is even the queerest thing about the universe. God can't be categorized or boxed in. The inexplicable mystery of God is a source of unspeakable anxiety. Finally, declaring the love of a wedded couple to be holy because love, too, defies all classifications and can never be bounded. It's just a feeling. It's a feeling. Is a state that we have. It's a state that we are. Love is also queer. Love is queer. It can't be limited by our understandings of roles and gender. That's not a piece of halakha. That's not a piece of tradition. That's Gil Steinlauf's beautiful sermon. Reaching out to our LGBTQ brethren is a challenge to be rooted when we are rooted in Torah, which contains what appear to be discriminatory or inflammatory or insensitive comments and understandings of homosexuality, cross-dressing, and transgenderism. But I want to shed some light or offer a crack in what seem to be dogmatic, doctrinaire, and categorical statements about LGBTQ life. So I'm going to have to skip ahead to Deuteronomy. One of those other Tovat Hashem is to say, a man's item, kli gever, let's stick to that phrase, kli gever should not be worn on a woman, and a woman should not wear a woman's garment, a simla. Whoever does such thing is Tovat Hashem, a taboo against God. So then we reach the question, what is a kli gever? What is a man's item? So one of the initial suppositions in a very early Aramaic translation was that kli gever is talit and tefillin. We understood, also difficultly, that for centuries, only men were allowed to do this. And in past decades, we've reached a better understanding that it is a shared mitzvah. And there are some speculation that even Rashi's daughters, since he bore no sons, they wore tefillin, and I don't know his logic for that. And the other thing that suggested that this prohibition against seeming cross-dressing might be is that women should not bear shields and swords, as Wonder Woman does in the new trailer for Wonder Woman. Just a personal passion for Wonder Woman. I've always loved her. I always will. And we see this illustrated metaphorically in the way that Yael kills Sisera in the Haftarah for Beshalach with a tent peg, which is to say she doesn't kill him with a weapon of war. She does it in a feminine way. Not, I don't want to go too far into that, but that is a proof text our sages consider. And again, to return to the question of homosexuality and what it pertains to, the majorities of opinions, and I'm citing Rabbi John J. Tilson, who lives in New Haven, Connecticut, at this day and age, which is the site of a university which I believe is still accredited this year. I'm not sure. It may not be accredited anymore. Every year they struggle with accreditation, I hear. So Rashi and a few others think that one of the prohibitions against cross-dressing is really a prohibition against using cross-dressing to initiate sexual relations, that it would be a way to slip into the narrowed confines of women. You know, you imagine older societies, there was a lot of gender segregation. So maybe if you cross-dressed, you could slip into the women's bathhouse, the women's concession area of a home and initiate relations. Maybe. Doesn't seem so likely. And one of the reasons we see we can further this guess is that you're allowed to dress in an opposite gender on Purim. When it's done for gaiety, for joy, and not for sexually illicit reasons, it's permitted. And another possibility is that what was really being prohibited was intimate shaving, depilation of one's body. It's also so as to enter precincts that were specific to another gender or sexuality. Maybe. I'm just putting all that out there to say that it's not clear what the concern is about dressing as a man if you were born a woman, or dressing as a woman if you were born a man. Our sages, I want to reach an odd conclusion, which is opposite to the way our American society and Western society has reacted to these issues. We've become much more comfortable with homosexuality a decade or two or three before we reach comfort and equity with transgender relations. To our sages, it actually worked the other way. There are stories, confirmed stories, of, and I couldn't find the original citation this week. I looked quite a bit. I think it was in Prague in the 17th century, of someone who was born physically woman, identified in his adult life as a man, and was counted in an Orthodox minion, which is to say the entire society recognized him for his chosen gender identity. It was at least two centuries ago, if not three. So we have experiences of this. And our sages didn't see gender as so binary either. There are cases even in the Mishnah of what to do in cases of hermaphroditic gender, someone who has both or neither gender sexual organs. They were a lot more broad-minded in some ways than we might guess. So I want to leave you with a very interesting teaching by the Tzitz Eliezer, who was a 20th century rabbi. I think at some point he was the chief rabbi of Israel. He's Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg. And the way we come to know about our sages' references to transgender persons is through very interesting questions. What prayers might that person say? And more commonly, if you married someone who was a woman and that woman became a man, do you need a get? Do you need an official bill of divorcement? Generally, the answer is no, you don't. Because by changing gender, the marriage was retroactively annulled. We did not understand this person's gender when they engaged and consummated the betrothal. And these are no longer the same people, effectively, who entered into the marriage. Therefore, it's retroactively annulled. There is no need, says the Tzitz Eliezer, for a get, because he is a man and not a woman, even though he had been born a woman. And, says the Tzitz Eliezer elsewhere, that person can recite the phrase, God who made me a man, the traditional blessing that we say in the morning. Again, problems of sexual hierarchy aside, just to illustrate that our sages regularly understood gender to be something that is only identified in the head and not between the legs. They had that very, I think, advanced understanding of human gender and sexuality in some ways. I want to leave you with something from the Tzitz Eliezer that's quite beautiful. Zehuto vichuso shel hadam einenu matbea benifrad bechelke averav v'tiyena hachushuvim beyoter. I'm going to use this translation that I found, but the identity and the linkages and the birthright of a person is not expressed by one's organs, but by the spirit and soul therein. The Chatam Sofer, one of his intellectual forebears, got it right when he wrote that the body is not the human. Rather, the body is a bag made of dust, and within that physical bag there is wisdom, knowledge, and thoughts, which are the true definitions of personality. So thank you for bearing with me for something that was more lecture than sermon. I think it's very easy to go in the wrong one as a pastor. But I did want to illustrate for those who are genderqueer, gender non-binary, transgender, homosexual, bisexual, and other self-identities sexually, personally, in terms of gender, Pink isn't a color that belongs to anyone. Purple doesn't belong to anyone. I struggled for a long time as a child because I don't really like talking about sports. And I had no interest in fixing cars. And I love music and I loved theater. And yet, I've never actually thought about having gender dysphoria. What I have a problem with is enforced gender identity and pigeonholing. It just doesn't matter. We should be allowed to love whom we want to love and identify as we want to identify and have our interests and our life and lived experience be chosen. Those are all separate decisions. Those don't have to be linked to our biology. And our tradition was not so monolithic, and it was not so categorical as we might think. Torah often speaks categorically, but that's sometimes the fault of translation. That's sometimes the fault of not understanding the Torah as we have come to understand Torah. And as I've said before, even if and even when Torah appears amoral or immoral or problematic, the guiding purpose, I think, of Torah, to quote Martin Luther King, is to bend the arc of history toward justice. It may not be itself just. Our Mishnah may not be itself just by our understanding of the term. Our 14th century sages may not be themselves just by our context. But I feel, through my study and through my guts, that the effort was always to bend history toward justice. They could only bend it as much as they understood what history was at that time. And we must continue to do so. For our sakes, for the sake of our LGBTQ brethren, and for the sake of all children who should be allowed to wear pink pajamas and have long hair, or in one of my finest moments of parenting, I saw Elchanan in his 3-year-old class and the girls were playing princess. And I was about to say, Elchanan, do you want to be a prince? And I stopped myself. I was very proud. I said, Elchanan, would you like to be a princess too? That's where I hope we go.